Good morning, everybody. This numerical course starts for real today. There'll be several sections of the course, three or four sections. The first one is on linear algebra. And in case you did not know, the world runs on linear algebra. Basically, everything is linear algebra. I mean, if you solve a partial differential equation, a derivative, of course, is a linear operator. Integration is a linear operator. Functions form a vector space. You can add functions and scale functions. So dealing with functions is linear operations. You can expand functions into a basis, for example, a Fourier expansion into Chebyshev functions, spherical harmonics, and so on. If you expand a function into basis, that, of course, is a linear operation that you're doing. And a Fourier transform is a linear operation. The Maxwell equation as partial differential equations is a linear set of partial differential equations. And if you have a complicated theory, for example, Einstein equations, that what many people do to understand it better is a perturbation about a certain solution, perturbation of curve, for example. And a perturbation means you linearize it. So the result is then a linear set of equations that you can study more easily. So everything is linear algebra. And oh, you might also like machine learning. Everybody likes machine learning these days. You have a neural network there. And each neuron, what it does, it has many inputs in one of these layers. And then it takes a linear combination of these inputs. So that's a linear operation. Of course, then you have the activation function. That's a bit of a nonlinear thing added on. But each layer or a neural network, the connectivity, this is all linear algebra. And okay, so I'm going to write notes in this notebook here. And first, I want to very briefly review what a vector space is, just because that might come up later on. So can you tell me the axioms of a vector space that define a vector space?
Yes.
Go ahead.
So we have a group under addition.
Okay. Very good. And that means you have addition and it's
inverse as well.
Did you have a negation as well, right? Minus x. And what else do you have?
Zero.
You have a zero element. Yes, that's right. It is zero. And what's the other thing for a vector space?
Scalar multiplication.
Thank you. And for the additive group, there's a bit more. You have associativity, and probably you want to demand commutativity and so on. But these are the basic rules of a vector space. There you go. It looks much better now. Anyway, the world runs on linear algebra, and computers are actually linear algebra machines. Now, you might think computers can do anything, right? They are general computing devices, but what they really do is they do linear algebra, and they do it really, really well. So in today's lecture, the lecture will have about four or three parts of this introduction. First, I want to tell you a bit about computers, the linear algebra, how fast computers actually are, just to put some performance numbers out there. Because although it might not be important in the course of this course, if you do some computing at some point, you'll find that your code runs too slow. And I want to give you some tools on the way to actually just know how fast the code should be. You know how to actually measure the speed of the code. And after that, there'll be a theoretical section in this lecture about where we talk about linear algebra and how you theoretically judge the cost of an algorithm. Going to introduce the big O notation. And in the last part of today's lecture, I'll talk about actual linear algebra operations and what one should do and not, things like solving linear systems and so on. So let's begin with actual performance of computers, how good computers are at linear algebra. This is just a show and tell of some performance numbers here. And I looked it up yesterday, how fast my computer is. So the speed of a computer is measured in two ways. The old way that everybody likes to use, and that is unfortunately mostly useless today, is you count the number of operations that a computer can do per second. We're using floating point numbers for vectors, so floating point operations per second is also called FLOP, floating point operation, FLOP, just a cute acronym. So let's first look at the FLOP rate of a computer, FLOP per second. Floating point operation. I don't know, the op probably means two things. And so I have my laptop here, which has an Intel CPU. And as I mentioned, I looked it up yesterday. It runs at 2.4 gigahertz. So that is the base of the speed. My CPU has 8 cores that run independently. So it's not just running at 2.4 gigahertz. So the actual speed is 8 times faster because there are 8 cores in the CPU. And then it also turns out that each core these days of a CPU, they don't execute the instructions one after the other. They are what is called superscalar. They can execute multiple instructions at the same time if the instructions are independent. So if you calculate something like A plus B plus C, these are not independent, because if you want to add C, then you need to finish the calculation of A plus B first. But if you calculate A plus B and C plus B, then you can perform this addition and this addition at the same time. And the CPU could actually do that, because it has internally two of the functional units that can do floating point operations. So we get another factor of 2. Now, you might think that the CPU acts on individual floating point numbers, but they don't. Most CPUs these days have so-called SIMD, single instruction, multiple data units. This core here can actually perform operations on vectors of a length of up to 4. So each instruction can add up to 4 numbers, and it can do 2 of these per cycle. So there's an factor of 4. And finally, the instructions that the CPU performs is not actually just a multiplication or an addition. It's called a fused multiply add instructions. So it can calculate A times B plus C. That's one operation with 3 inputs. It's a single operation. So we want to count this as 2 operations because it's a multiplication on the addition. So the actual speed is this. And if you saw multiply it all out, this gives you about 300 gigaflop per second, about 300 billion operations per second that the CPU can perform. Again, sorry, it doesn't switch to markdown mode. And how do I edit it now? Oh, sorry. And 300 billion is just an insane large number. I don't know, have you tried to count to a billion? 1 billion seconds is about 30 years. So it's for a human, it's basically impossible to count to a billion. So 300 billion operations is an insanely large number. CPUs are really fast these days. But this computer doesn't just have a CPU built in, it also has a GPU built in by AMD, another company. And I looked that up. This GPU has a performance of about 4,000 gigaflop per second. For single precision. Single precision has only has only about 7 digits of accuracy. That is less than what the CPU does. If you use single precision on the CPU, it would be about twice as fast. So this is again about 5 times faster, that is 4 trillion operations per second. And GPU means graphics processing unit, because their history is in producing graphics. And graphics is essentially just Euclidean geometry. If you play a computer game and there's a 3D world, then what happens is all the surfaces, I don't know, Mario's knobbly nose and the face and so on, gets all split into individual triangles. And then these triangles are projected onto the screen so that you know how it looks like. And that happens about 60 times per second. So if you have your scene with about, say, 1 million triangles times 60 times per second, that would be 60 million triangles per second, But if we have here 4 trillion floating point operations, you see that it's not a problem at all. And since Euclidean geometry, graphics is linear algebra, and all the other computing is linear algebra, it all fits nicely together. And we can use these GPUs also to perform useful scientific calculations. And this actually computer has another GPU in well, a second one, Intel GPU with about 400 gigaflop per second. I am not typing well, sorry. And this is much slower. As you see, I guess it uses much less energy. That makes sense for a laptop. If you are on random battery, use the slow one. If you play a fast 3D game, use the fast one. It uses more power. Now, this is the speed of computers in terms of floating point operations. And people act as if this was the important speed. It actually isn't. Very surprising. Actually, the slow thing is actually transferring data. Because if you have these million triangles, the data needs to come from somewhere. It's probably stored in the memory of the computer. And accessing data in memory also takes a certain amount of time. So this is called the memory bandwidth. And it's measured in bytes per second. And the system memory here has about 42 gigabyte per second, and AMD GPU has a faster memory that has about 192 gigabyte per second. So let's see whether, oh, this does not look nice. How can I make it look nice? Do I need more dashes here? Yeah, that's about that. Well, don't like the spaces here. And as a physicist, astrophysicist, I think it's the same in other parts of physics as well. If we have two numbers with different units, we can combine them, multiply. So we have floating point operations per second and bytes per second. Now we can calculate the ratio and then get rid of the seconds. And one other thing. I have here bytes per second, and above I have talked about double position numbers. Do you know how many bytes one needs for a double position number? One double precision number, thank you, where double is 8 bytes. So if we convert this 42 gigabytes per second into how many numbers we can read per second, that's about 5 giga, I don't know, numbers per second, which is the memory bandwidth. And let's compare that to the number of calculations. That was 300 gigaflop per second, and then the ratio, which is the number of flop to the number of numbers that we can read or write, which is then, if you can do the calculation, I want to calculate the ratio, how many floating point operations I can do in the same time it takes to read a single number from memory. What is that? Okay, I should probably use the same here. Sorry. This is flop per second. Let's just call it reads here, right? How many memory reads? Let's ignore writes. Reads per second. And then flop per memory read. One memory read is reading one number from memory. What is that number then? Does it make sense, Dustin? Am I doing something wrong here?
Is it 60?
It's 60, yes. I don't know. It's probably too simple. That is, if you're reading a bunch of numbers from memory, one after the other, then one number arrives, and then you have time to do 60 floating point operations before the next number arrives. So if you have a large, say a vector of numbers, say a million numbers, and want to add them all up, the first number arrives, then you do the addition, And then you wait, because you could do 59 other floating point operation, but there's nothing to do. You just need to wait until the next one arrives. That is, if you want to add up 1 million numbers, then the time to add them is 60 times less than the time to actually read them from memory. The performance is completely dominated by how many numbers you need to read from memory and write from memory. So, I don't know, we can completely neglect the time it takes to actually read something from memory. And let me capture that here. Usually people calculate byte per flop or something, not numbers per flop, but I think bytes per flop is a useless number because you always want to read a double precision number. Okay, so I don't know, you are probably a generation, if you're interested in computers and performance, that grows up with the idea that memory accesses are much slower, and that if you want to optimize the code, you need to reduce the amount of data that is read from memory and written to memory. Whereas in the olden times, when the Fortran dinosaurs still roamed the earth, then it actually, the memory was much faster compared to the CPU. And at that time, the floating point performance was the limiting factor, but that's not the case anymore. So these days, it's also about memories, and the floating point operations are basically useless. So this here are the important performance characteristics, and this here, not so much. Okay, this is just to put some numbers in here. These numbers change every year, of course. So next year, in 2 years, orders of magnitude, they are still okay, but in 10 years, these numbers will be useless. And of course, the number 300 gigaflop, I mean, it's not important that it's 300, but the performance of a GPU is measured in teraflop. And the performance of a memory is measured in gigabytes per second and so on. And it's not megabytes and it's not terabytes per second, it's gigabytes and so on and so forth. These orders of magnitude are relevant. Okay, now this is about the speed of the actual hardware. Next, I want to discuss algorithms as a more of a theoretical topic. And to measure the speed of an algorithm, people often use what is called a big O notation. And I don't know whether you're familiar with that. Are you? Okay, can you define the big O notation?
Yeah, I'm not sure I can define it correctly.
Okay. Yeah, no, I mean the actual definition is a bit complicated.
Yeah.
So actually, a big O notation says how much, how fast the function grows for big numbers, for big values, big function arguments, and you ignore constants. And for example, of order n squared, that grows faster than order n. And the definition is here, order of f of n. So f of n is a function of n, is defined as the set of all functions g of n, such that there exists, writing it out, a constant c and the number n0. Oh, it doesn't do the n0. Okay, such that g of n is less than or equals c times f of n, that one we had of the left n, left side, for all n larger than or equals n0. Doesn't look nice. Does it look nicer if I write it like that? Whatever. I wish I could use LaTeX here. Maybe later. Anyway, that means you compare how fast the function grows. You only care what happens for big numbers larger than this S0. It doesn't matter what happens for small numbers. And also, there is a constant in here. Let me give you some examples. Of some functions that lie in this set order n squared. Of course, the function n squared is in there, but 2n squared is also in there because constants don't matter. And of course, 100n squared is also of the order n squared. And you can have also n squared plus n, because if You can, n is for, if large enough, always less than n squared. You can, and you can also have n squared plus 100 n. If you choose n naught equals 100, then of course n is larger than 100, and then 100 n is less than n squared, so this is then less than 2 n squared, and it's the same thing. And if you have something like n squared times, say, the log of n, this is actually not in order n squared, because the log grows unboundedly. And order n squared is an important class. Other important classes, of course, are of order n and order n cubed. And people would never write order, say, 2n squared, because order 2n squared, constants don't matter. It's the same as order n squared. You just add that constant. This is just the more complicated way of writing order n squared. So people would never write this. And I am thinking about, there are certain problems if you want to discretize phase space or something. Look at certain dark matter models where the computational cost goes like n to the seventh, which is of course absolutely large. If you have, say, a discretization of space and you have 100 grid points in every direction, then altogether you have 10 to the 14 grid points. And there are certain algorithms that reduce that cost to the order of, say, n times log n to the sixth power. And that is much, much cheaper than this for large n. But there is a huge factor in front of it that you don't see in here. And that factor is probably 1,000 or 10,000. So for small n, this algorithm is still cheaper than that one. For large n, of course, which is the only thing about which the big O notation talks, for large n, this would be much cheaper. Okay, and now I want to talk about certain operations that you do on vectors, for example, adding vectors, dot product, matrix multiplications, and let's talk about the cost of these operations. I want to set up a table here. So let's define the table. Oh, I'm just erasing things. I could just move. Yeah, I'm not used to that. Okay. Here is the certain operation. And here is the cost and the number of floating point operations. And here the cost and the number of memory accesses. And let's assume we have vectors of length n and matrices with size n that then have n squared elements and so on. And let's just think about this. So we're adding vectors. This is x plus y. How many floating point operations do you need to add these vectors? Well, the vector has the length n. The cost is n. But we don't really care about the details. So we just write the cost is of the order n. And how much memory do we need? Well, x and y each have length n, so that's 2n. You probably want to store the result as well. That's 3n. And the cost is such, therefore, of the order of n, because we don't care about the factor of 3. Now let's calculate the dot product. How many floating point operations do we need for that? We have the two vectors, we write them next to each other, and then element wise we write the multiplications, that's n multiplications, and then we also need to add up the sum, that's n minus 1 additions, so it's n plus n minus 1, that's of the order n, and again of the order of n, because n minus 1 of the order n, because the minus 1 doesn't matter, and order n plus order n is order 2n, which is the same as order n. Sorry, my laptop wants to fall asleep. So that's again of the order n operation. It's about the same cost. And how many memory accesses do we need? It's 2n. Actually, for the addition, it's 3n because we need to read x and y and write the result. But of course, it's of the order n. And for the dot product, we need to read each of x and y. That's 2n and store the result. The result is a scalar, so it's 2n plus 1. But 2n plus 1 is, of course, again, of the order n. Okay. Now it's getting a bit more complicated. Now let's multiply a matrix and a vector. Let's first talk about the amount of memory that we need. How much memory, how many memory accesses do we need for that? So we certainly need to read the full vector. That's n numbers that we read. And we also need to read the matrix. How many elements does the matrix have?
n squared.
So the number is n squared plus n memory accesses. And we also need to write the result back to memory. They're going to be n results. So it's n squared plus 2n. And if we use the big O notation, what would that be?
Order n squared,
exactly. Because for large n, 2n is always less than n squared. So for large n, this is less than 2n squared, and 2n squared and n squared is the same thing. So here we have the order n squared. Let me write that here, because now it's more expensive. And how many operations do we need for a matrix vector multiplication? I don't know, let me. We have a matrix here, and we have a vector, and then we write the result. How many operations do we need?
It's n times the previous one.
It's n times this, you say?
Yes, right, because we have n vectors to multiply and sum.
Very good, yes. So matrix vector multiplication is just a bunch of dot products, n of these exactly. So this is of the order of n squared. If you calculate it exactly, it's something like 2n squared minus 2 or something, but it's of the order of n squared. So a dot product is much cheaper than a matrix vector multiplication in both cases. We can also do something even more expensive, namely multiplying two matrices with each other. How expensive is this? Let's talk about how many memory accesses we need. If we have two matrices, then we have one matrix, and we multiply it with another matrix. And the result, of course, is a... Let's just assume the matrix is square. If it's non-square, it gets more complicated, but you can figure that out. So how much memory do we need in this case? How many memory accesses?
So memory access is like when we read and when we write.
Yes. Exactly.
3n squared then.
Exactly. Each matrix is n squared. We read 2n squared, write 1n squared, so it's 3n squared. But of course, 3n squared is, in terms of order of magnitude, the same as n. Sorry. Yes, same as n squared. So order n squared. And now, how many floating point operations do we need?
N cubed.
Yes. So a matrix vector multiplication is kind of a building block for matrix multiplication. You can kind of split this up into lots of column vectors and the right-hand side as well. And each of these, each of these column vectors here is a respective matrix vector multiplication that we had up here, order n squared. So since there are n columns here, it's of the order n cubed. No. I'm not sure whether using orders of magnitude here was a good idea. I thought it would simplify things. because otherwise you might have things like 3n cubed minus 2n squared plus 15 or something. And I wanted to keep it simple here, but I hope that the using the big O notation doesn't actually make it more confusing. So in terms of cost, you see that they're very different costs. There are certain things that have a cost linear in the number of numbers, that is kind of fine. But here the matrix-matrix multiplication have cost n cubed, that is the most expensive one. And it's only the only one where the cost in terms of calculations is much larger than the cost of memory accesses. It's the only one where the two columns are actually different. And that means this matrix multiplication is the only thing where the compute performance of CPUs, of course, actually matters. In all these others, the memory cost, accessing memory, is, I mean, you have kind of the same number of memory accesses than floating point operations. And since this is, well, 10 times more expensive, all these algorithms are limited by memory access. And matrix multiplication is kind of the only algorithm in all of scientific computing, essentially. Well, not quite, but it's one of the few that is actually limited by floating point performance and where it makes sense to have fast GPUs and tensor cores and other operations. But otherwise, it's mostly limited by memory access. And should we continue a bit more here in this direction? Or should we skip it? I think it's getting more complicated here. But what I was going to talk next about, it how much it costs to actually solve a linear system. Let me just hand wave it without going into too much details.
Professor, so is inverse cubic as well?
Yes, it is. I hope so. A times x equals b. Let's write it like this, because we're looking for x, we're solving the linear system. And you all know how to solve a linear system, but I think you learned that in undergrad lectures or something. You could use Gaussian elimination on this matrix. And if you use Gaussian elimination, then you have one matrix, and then you take, say, the first row, and you add multiples of that row to all the other rows to, say, get a zero in the first column here. And since you're touching all the other elements of that matrix, it's of the order of n squared operations. And that puts zeros in the first row, to put zeros in all the other rows, you need a factor of n more operations. So this is also of the order of n cubed operations. And storage is order n squared, because you just need to store the matrix here. Okay, that gives you a bit of a feeling of costs of adding things and so on. And we can also measure that on a computer. There's a package called Benchmark Tools. Sorry, let's add it here. And then there's a command, add benchmark. You'll all get the access benchmark. There we do so. Oh, no. Okay, we need to get some matrices first, of course, because we want to do something. Let's say take two matrices and multiply them. A equals, and there's a command, rand n, that gives you a random matrix. And I just use a 2000 by 2000 matrix. I don't want to output it, so I add a semicolon at the end that suppresses the output. And I want to have two of these. What happened? So I get two. Not good at typing today. And then we benchmark multiplying them, and then let's see how long it takes. Now, 2000 by 2000 matrices, how many floating point operations does that take? So it's of the order of cubed, 2000 cubed. And I didn't write it down, but there was a factor 2 in front of it, because we need to perform one multiplication and one addition for the dot product, because it all goes back to dot products. So it's 2 times 2,000 cubed operations. Cubed. And the speed of this computer was, we said it earlier, about 300 gigaflops per second. So this is the number of loading point operations, 2 times 2,000 cubed that it takes. The speed is 300 giga operations per second. So if we divide by this, we should get the number of seconds that it takes to perform these matrix multiplications. And here the benchmarking, it actually did 60 samples, and each sample evaluated the function once. There's a minimum, a maximum, a median, a mean. Look at the nice statistics here. Most of them finished in 60 microseconds. Some took about 100 milliseconds here, and so on. And now let's see what our theoretical performance said. Our theoretical performance says this thing should cost about 53 milliseconds. And the actual measure time is, what was the median? 91. That's about twice as much. Anyway, this is kind of experimental physics, right? Because we do an experiment and a theoretical calculation, and we're off by a factor of 2, and that is not bad for all you can do. Yes? Mm.
So first, like, Julia scans the matrix and then picks the algorithm how to multiply, or how does it know? You know what I'm saying?
Yes. What Julia does, it looks at the size of the matrix and says, oh, it's big. And then it looks at the type and says, oh, double precision. And then it selects a particular algorithm. And in this case, that particular algorithm comes pre-compiled. There's a library called OpenBLAST that does that, and it calls that library. And that library will continue to analyze the matrix and says, oh, 2000, I have this kind of CPU. Let's split the matrix into 8 bits, one for each of the cores, and so on and so forth. It looks at the capabilities of the CPU, knows that the CPU has this length 4 vectors, and it uses these, and so on and so forth. And I don't know where that factor of 2 comes from. Well, in the ideal case here, it's 60 milliseconds instead of the 53. That is the overhead of all the threads talking to each other, and so on and so forth. And now I only talked about floating point operations. The memory bandwidth also has a particular cost. It's much lower because it's only of order n squared, but it's also non-negligible. This is why we are slightly off here. If we were to add matrices, then the cost that we would be, I mean, if we just look at the floating point operation, it would give us a very wrong idea of how long it takes. Let's just do that. If we add matrices, then it should be much faster. Should be much faster than 60 milliseconds. It runs the benchmark multiple times. 10 milliseconds. Ideal 6 milliseconds, okay. And what's the estimated cost of adding 2 matrices? Well, it's just 2,000 squared, right? Because we have just need to add the elements together. So our cost would be 10 microseconds, and instead it takes about 10 milliseconds. Because what we did here, we estimated a cost in terms of floating point operations, but the true cost is, of course, the memory bandwidth, and therefore we are off by a factor of 1,000 here. Okay, maybe that was too complicated. Anyway, what I showed you here in this part of the lecture is I gave you some performance numbers for how fast computers are. This is a laptop. You can repeat that for your laptops or for a supercomputer. And I showed you the big O notation, and we briefly analyzed some simple algorithms, showing you how fast algorithms are, and then we compared the cost of the algorithm in terms of this one with the actual speed of a computer. And if you ever have a code and the code is slow, then what you need to do in principle is do an analysis like that. You look at your algorithm, think about how many memory accesses you have, how many floating point operation, what is the limited factor, and then you compare it to the actual code that you're running. Of course, this is, I mean, adding vectors is really simple as it comes to algorithms. If you have a Monte Carlo method doing something, comparing something to a measurement or something, it's much more complicated in the end, which is why few people do it. But you should know how to do that in principle. Okay, and running a bit over time here, but that is fine. I now want to talk some actual algorithms that are available for linear algebra in Julia. Sorry, do you have questions, comments, more ideas? Okay, of course, what we could also do, oh no, let's just do that. I don't know what's the result of that, so this is going to be exciting for me. I want to calculate how long it takes to add two matrices in terms of memory operations. I want to count the memory operations. So the matrices have a site of 2,000 squared. We have three memory accesses per matrix, because we need to read both of the inputs and then we need to write the output. And the total memory bandwidth was about 5 giga, whatever, accesses per second. And if we put the number, this says 2.4 milliseconds. And we measured 6 milliseconds. Okay, that's closer, right? Same order of magnitude. I call that a success. Who knows what other overheads there are. Okay, linear algebra algorithms in Julia. Julia has linear algebra operations built in, but they're not available by default. You need to load a particular package, which is called linear algebra. It's built into Julia. It doesn't need to download it, but just to make sure you're not accidentally using any linear algebra operations, these are there. There is a function called zero that gives you the zero element of the vector space. Zero, three gives you a vector with three elements. What? Zeros. I am sorry. There. And if you do zeros, 3, 3, you get a zero matrix with three elements. I already used rand n. This gives you random numbers, a vector. There's also another function called rand, which gives you a uniformly distributed random number. Sorry, a random number drawn from a uniform distribution. And that's a uniform distribution between 0 and 1. So the numbers are always positive or non-negative and always less than 1. And in most cases, that's less useful than normal distributed. Normal distributed can be positive or negative. They're kind of symmetric about 0. They're kind of close to 0, but they can also be large. Whereas rand gives you these numbers between 0 and 1. And if you have a matrix, let's just define something. Rand n, 3, 3, and vector. You can look at the size of the matrix, 3 by 3. Size of the vector, just 3 elements. And type of, yeah, that works as well. Type of A. A is a matrix with float 64, 64-bit numbers. They have about 15 digits of accuracy. And this is just an alias for an array with two dimensions of float 64. And type of X is an array with one dimension of float 64 numbers. A basic operation would be, for example, a transpose. Transpose can be written like that, A transpose. And you knew the type of the transpose is an adjoint with element float 64 with the matrix of float 64. So if you calculate the transpose, this guy's the adjoint of a matrix, Julia does not actually perform the memory operations to move the numbers around, because memory operations are expensive. It just remembers in the type of the matrix, that's a transpose. So if you access an element, it just swaps the indices when accessing it. And that is essentially for free. So calculating a transpose is basically zero cost here in Julia, whereas if you actually copied numbers around, that would be super expensive. And this is why that isn't there. And this is probably the first case where you see where something that you do on a piece of paper when you talk about operators is very different from what you do in linear algebra. If you have small matrices with 3x3 elements, no one cares about these things. But if the matrices are large, have thousands of elements, millions of elements, then the cost actually becomes important. Also, sometimes a matrix is symmetric. Sorry, don't know what's happening here. And if you say multiply matrices, then if you know it's symmetric, there might be a cheaper algorithm to do so. And you can write symmetric of A, and that is also recorded in the type, and you know it symmetrized the matrix, probably by taking, I don't know, the upper triangle or something. 0.38, 0.3, I have no idea what it did. Yeah. Anyway, this is probably the upper triangle because it's kind of the lower triangle in the adjoint. By the way, in English, people say lower and upper triangular matrix. In German, we say left and right triangular matrix. That's a weird thing. Okay. We already briefly talked about solving a linear system, that is this A under X gives you a solution. And you can also calculate, say, the determinant of a matrix, and you can invert the matrix. You all know how to multiply numbers, right? Elementary school, digit by digit, and so on, long addition, long division. And you know how to multiply matrices, tedious, but you know the algorithm. You know how to solve a linear system here using Gaussian elimination. I don't know, do you call it Gaussian elimination in English, or what name do you have here?
Yeah.
How do you invert a matrix? Did you learn that algorithm?
Yes.
Okay, how do you do it?
Minors.
Pardon?
Minor expansion.
Expansion?
Yeah, minor expansion.
Sorry, I didn't hear that. Mm.
Minors?
Minors? Oh, you use the minors. Okay, yes. Oh, interesting. Interesting. Yes, I guess that would work. Okay, yeah. Computers would actually do it differently if you do that. If you... if you have a linear system like this, A times X equals B, then you know how to put A in the, use the Gaussian elimination for this vector. You, as you transform A, you also transform the right-hand side, and then you can X, can get X from that. You can solve multiple linear systems for X1, X2, X2 with multiple right-hand sides, B1, B2, B3 at the same time. And that means you can also solve an equation of that type, A times X equals B, where X is any kind of matrix. It can be something by one matrix, which just makes it a vector, or it can be a large matrix. You can have as many right-hand sides here as you want, right? So the shape of A and X can be different. But in particular, you can also choose B to be the identity matrix. And then if you solve for X, then of course,
yeah,
X is the inverse.
Yeah.
So what the linear algebra package would do, most likely, it depends on the details, of course, if you invert a matrix, it solves many, many linear systems, I mean, n linear systems. But it's optimized. A would be put into triangular form only once, but there would be n right-hand sides. And that means if you want to solve A times X equals B, and then you write inverse of A times B, because you think that's the solution, that is a tremendously bad idea. Oh, okay, sorry, I need to get a new matrix B first because I defined a thing. And then I can actually do that here. Because what happens here is that when you calculate the inverse, it would solve many, many linear systems. essentially one for each row of A or of B, and then do the matrix multiplication. But your idea was to solve one linear system. So this is much more expensive. And this is why you usually should never do that. So the rule of thumb is don't invert a matrix. I mean, there are exceptions, of course. But whenever you want to invert a matrix, you should remember inverting a matrix is expensive. The natural operation is to solve a linear system. So if you can rewrite things in terms of solving a linear system that is more efficient, it's faster. And also, if you have fewer operations, you also have a smaller error. The more operations, right, every time you get an error, 10 to the minus 15. But if you have millions, trillions of operations, the bits add up. So don't do that. So if you write something on a blackboard, it's A inverse. A inverse, that's kind of the basic thing. Solving a linear system, you'd say, oh, just invert A. But algorithmically, it's the other way around. Algorithmically, the inverse is the expensive thing, and the basic building block is solving a linear system. So write it in terms of solving something. There are exceptions, of course.
So how much more expensive it is? Is it like constant or like order difference?
So if you write it like that, then getting 8 into A, the matrix, into the LU form, that needs to be done only once. So for a dense matrix, for a full matrix that we have here, that is the same cost. And then the back substitution for a linear system, that is of the order n squared. And if you invert it, that's of the order n cubed. So in terms of big N notation, it's the same. It's probably a factor 2 or something overall that's more expensive. But there are other things. Because A might have certain special properties. You know, operators can have properties. Operators can be symmetric, for example.
Yeah.
But I distinguish between operators and matrices. An operator is the linear thing that has the nice properties. A matrix is a representation of an operator in a particular basis. And a matrix can have good properties. They would hold only in that basis. For example, the matrix could be tridiagonal. That's not an operator property. And if the matrix is tridiagonal, then most of the elements are zero. Multiplying by that matrix is super fast if it's order n, not order n squared. And n instead of n cubed, right? It's super fast. And if you invert a tridiagonal matrix, it becomes a full matrix. So you pick up an inefficiency of the order of n squared if you accidentally invert the matrix instead of solving a linear system. Sorry. Probably just n. Don't nail me down on these numbers here. But many matrices have special properties, and many algorithms are constructed to have these properties. That is important. And in the next lecture, I'm going to discuss sparse matrices, which is kind of general class. And I don't think Julia even has an algorithm to invert a sparse matrix. So you actually need to take some extra steps because it's so inefficient, and therefore no one does it. And therefore never implemented the respective algorithm. Okay, there's one more thing. First, of course, Julia is really built for linear algebra. There are many packages. I recommend looking at the documentation for anything. There's really a lot of things available, large amount of algorithms available. Oh, I wanted to show eigenvalues as well. That's probably interesting. We have this matrix A. What is it? It's eigen. I think it's eigen, right? Which gives you the eigen decomposition. There are the eigenvalues here, the complex, and the eigenvectors. We can symmetrize IA. I don't know what symmetric does. I don't think it symmetrizes it properly, right? It probably just takes one diagonal thing or something. Well, let's do that properly here. A plus A transpose. And then Julia realizes the matrix is symmetric, so the eigenvalues are no real numbers here. And there's also a singular value decomposition. Have you heard of that before? The advantage of a singular value decomposition is it works for all matrices, whether they're singular or not, rectangular, anything. It's just a nice decomposition. So you get this U and V transposed. And the actual singular values here. And this works for This can be really slow if the matrices are large, and sometimes you're only interested in some of the eigenvalues. So give me the top five eigenvalues. And there's another package called RPAC. What?
Oh,
now it needs to pre-compile. Anyway, RPAC is a well-known package, probably written Fortran or something, probably 30 years old. And this uses iterative methods, that instead of calculating all the eigenvalues at once, it uses an iterative algorithm, and that gives you one algorithm, one eigenvalue after the other, say the first five, that the five largest, five smallest, smallest absolute value, furthest away from zero, who knows what largest and smallest means for complex numbers, and so on, the various definitions that you can choose from and get these eigenvalues. And now I need to wait here. Anyway, the respective function is then called eigs, which gives you, I think, by default, the five largest eigenvalues and SVDs. Before it was SVDs, now we write SVD singular values. And the documentation of eigs also tells you what additional arguments you can give. For example, you can say, I want the 10 largest eigenvalues or the 10 smallest eigenvalues. Or here's a starting value. Or I want to solve a generalized eigenvalue problem, where there's another matrix B involved, and so on. Is anything happening here? Not okay. I think I argued myself in a corner here. And yeah, I think I'll stop here. There are a few other things I wanted to mention as well. Oh, maybe one thing, I'll just mention it in passing. If you multiply two matrices, you need to store the result somewhere. So it needs, Julia needs to allocate memory to store the result. And if you want to go for efficiency, you probably find that in the Julia decomposition, it makes sense to pre-allocate your memory. If you're running your algorithm in a loop and in every iteration you need to allocate memory, you can save the cost by allocating the memory only once. And then if you solve a system or multiply two matrices, you pass the result matrix in as well. Well, that kind of the undefined matrix that will hold the result in the future. So you could multiply CAB, and that tells Julia to multiply A and B and store the result into the matrix C. You don't have to worry about the ended course, but just since we talked about performance. Oh, it's done with that. What? Oh, the using. It didn't run the using. Okay. Now that, let me delete that. Eigenvalues, yay! There you go. Oh, A is a rather small matrix, 3x3. It doesn't want to calculate six eigenvalues for a 3x3 matrix. That doesn't make sense. So it only gives me one by default. And SVDs doesn't work. Okay, we can fix that. Make it a 10x10 matrix, and then we get something. Oh, wow, that, yeah, can't read anything here. But there are numbers here. I'm sure they are correct. Okay, that is today's lecture. I talked about computers, performance benchmarking, and we also discussed simple linear algebra algorithms, how to do that in Julia. And in the next lecture, I will continue with linear algebra and discuss other matrix representations, in particular sparse matrices. Sparse matrices contain lots of zeros, and that make many things much more efficient. And in many cases, all these n cubeds and n squareds will actually go to n, and this expensive operation here is then not necessary anymore. And then actually memory bandwidth becomes the most important thing in linear algebra calculations. Thank you.